This is the Liminalist, the podcast between. Part two of my conversation with Bennett Freeman of consentient.wordpress.com. How old are you?
35.
Okay, so I was going to say you grew up with Jimmy Savile. You didn't, but I mean, he was still around when you grew up, but not to the same extent for me. But yeah, I grew up in that cultural climate, the BBC, Top of the Pops, Jimmy Savile. That was my meat and potatoes. That was the morphogenetic field that I grew up in. And now we're discovering it. And if you follow the news in the UK, I certainly wouldn't normally, but just because of how it's one revelation of
I've explored fairly thoroughly the revelations about all of the kind of historical abuse that I've managed to come into contact with. So everything from Elmtree Guest House and the stuff in Belgium, the Dutroux stuff. I've looked into various instances of abuse and alleged abuse, and some of them I would say that from looking at it in the way that I have, it seems to me is fairly clear that it's abuse. And I would say that some of it, maybe you disagree with me, some of it that on reflection it probably looks like it's not real.
I'm sure there are false narratives being thrown out there, and so poisoning
I have
well.
I have a vague understanding, more than a vague understanding of it. I have a general understanding.
So what drew you to research that material?
Let me think. So I guess probably this seems like a real memory. I was probably in my mid-20s, at the start of my journey back into kind of thinking about things. And when I was looking at a whole load of, watching hundreds and hundreds of videos a day about everything that relates to, in a general sense, like New World Order type stuff, I came across this video called Beyond the Dutroux Affair. And basically, it started out with a kind of collage of photographs of leading European politicians, Gordon Brown and, I don't know, various other people. And then it was saying, it was one of those things where there's like a video and some weird music and then like closed caption stuff on the screen. It just said, I really encourage you to look into this because a survivor of a terrible ring of abuse and stuff in Belgium has named leading European politicians as being her abusers, among her abusers. And that was just like, wow, okay, that looks like something that really needs to be looked into. So I looked into that Dutroux affair, and then the next thing after that was probably, I don't know, it's very difficult because you've got a very large amount of information. It's very difficult for me to remember exactly when I came across certain things. But
I'm not so interested in the trail of breadcrumbs that you followed so much as what you feel drew you to it. What was the sort of compelling interest had for you?
Yeah, I guess then knowing your enemy. Yeah. So if there are a lot of people that sort of say, "Oh, well, these are just people that all they care about is money," right? So my view from the information that's been presented to me and my processing of it is that, yeah, they care about money, but there's something a lot deeper than that. They care about power, and they care about control, and they're psychopathic. Yeah, it's not for them. It's not like, oh, that looks, I want power. It's not a rational thing. They're just doing it. And so when I want to know my enemy, then I need to know, well, what motivates them and stuff. So knowing that when I encounter the possibility that, leading European politicians, on top of having all these other associations, may be involved in a kind of subculture that's a whole new ball game. I guess that was like, well, I'd like to know if that's true or not. Just as I'd like to know if it turned out that there were leading human elites that were in cahoots with extraterrestrial elites. If I knew that fact, if I'd uncovered that fact and I could understand it as a fact, it would completely change my view of who my enemy was and how I would then deal with them. I mean, all the while I know that they're humans and there's no kind of extraterrestrial or Loigor type stuff going on, and I can just see them as humans. If they're psychopathic humans, then I have that understanding of them. If they're psychopathic and pedophilic and all these other things, then I can say, well, these people need to be exposed and removed, completely removed from our paradigm. We need to find a way to move past them, to make them no longer part of it. So it's about knowing your enemy, I would say.
Right. Well, so there's an awful lot to go into there. I mean, the reason I asked was because if a person has an affinity for certain material, then it's worth asking why, right?
Yeah, I have the opposite of an affinity. It revolves.
Well, no, you're drawn to the research. That's an affinity.
Okay, but I mean, I hate it. I really have to.
It doesn't matter. It's like we're talking about at the beginning. You can have an identity that identifies with the group, or you can have a negative identity that disidentifies.
It's very difficult.
So, like Jung or whoever it was says, it doesn't matter what a man talks about. It doesn't matter how a man talks about a subject. It's what subject he talks about.
Okay.
So, like Christian ministers who are preaching about sex being the devil's tool, they have sex on their brain, right? So, this isn't to say that I'm suggesting anything, you know, dubious about your interest, or that you. I'm merely saying that there'd be something personal in you that wants to explore that, and the very idea that of having an enemy, you see, like I don't relate to that at all. Like we could talk a lot about that, and I've even been writing about it a little bit. Do you ever listen to Red Ice? I know you're into Alex Jones, so you probably
Red Ice. I wouldn't say I'm into him. I've taken some insights from him over the years, but
yeah,
that which represent a very small percentage of his output.
He was on your list of influences. That's why I said it.
Definitely, so,
but,
yeah.
But Red Ice, so Red Ice, you know Red Ice Radio?
That's Jeff Rentz, or?
No, it's Henrik Palmgren. He's in Sweden.
I've definitely seen stuff from those pages and podcasts. I don't always remember the details. Yeah.
So, but I just bring it up because they've become more and more activist as a alternate kind of perceptions platform. They've become more and more political and activist, and without going into any of the specifics, the overall thing is know thy enemy, that these psychopaths have to be removed from our paradigm. I'm quoting you now, but it's very close to their perspective, in order that we can actually, you know, live the way we want to live. And that is a point of view that completely leaves out psychology. It just completely doesn't allow for psychological nuance. Yeah, like the psychopaths that are a different species. It's exactly the same mentality that Hitler and the Nazis applied to the Jews.
Okay, let me just stop you. I think there's been a misunderstanding. Actually, when I wrote about psychopaths, I actually wrote against the idea of those people that say there is something different in them, and therefore that is who they are.
Okay, so then how are they your enemy, though?
Oh, because of the fact that they want to kill me.
Well, do they? I mean, are they trying to kill you?
Yeah, if I live the way that I wanted to live.
But is it individuals or is it a system? I mean, the system is set up now that you can't even work on your own car, or you can't milk your own cows. I mean, the system itself is becoming so restricting and anti-life that, yeah, it's an enemy, but it's an abstract enemy. It's a system. So it doesn't really make sense to me. Like in the Matrix movie, it wouldn't really make sense for those people in the Matrix to see the Matrix as their enemy. It's the environment that they're in, and they're trying to get free of it, but getting free of it isn't the same as opposing it. Like opposing it seems to me that you reinforce the thing that you're opposing. You're playing the game on its own
All
terms, it
right,
seems to me.
let me clarify then. While I myself don't want to take any part in mass society and would like to escape that and live in a small, genuine intentional community or enclave, whatever you want to call it. When I say let's get, I don't mean let's get rid of them like I'm some kind of banner waving. Oh, let's get rid of these people. I just think that if there's going to be any surviving larger communities, because I just don't think that these elements can or would exist in small communities. They're a
They're kind
result
of
of mass
fast, yeah.
society, and there is a result of the system that you've just been talking about. So I think that though, put it this way, when the Savile stuff came out, and it shocked a lot of people, it shouldn't really have shocked them as much as it should, but when it came out, even if you're going to say, okay, we don't need to get rid of government, we're going to keep a government, we're going to keep a mass society, we're going to do something, if there is a we to do anything, then if there's any kind of sense or morality in that we, then the thing that they ought to do is find all the people that are responsible and get rid of them. That's what I think. And it's not like I'm out there banging the streets saying, let's get rid of these people. I hope that if there's any continuation of mass society, that one of the things it does is to get rid of that element of itself.
Wouldn't that be like somebody trying to perform brain surgery on themselves? I mean, how does the mass that spawns the system that creates or allows to flourish these sociopaths, how is it going to perform an extraction on its own organs?
Or perhaps
Like,
you're right. Perhaps the type of people that would be able to desire that, and to recognize that it's there and to want to get rid of it, maybe in doing so, they would have to necessarily break down their own internal supports for all the other stuff, for capitalism and government and all the other bad stuff. So,
I think it's a house of cards for sure, yeah. I mean, institutions have supported these
okay.
behaviors
So
and
there, you've helped me in that way to think. Okay, there's no potential for just dealing with these, with the abusive and psychopathic end of all that stuff without perhaps getting rid of everything else as well. But all I'm saying is that when you're asking me about how I look at it and view on it, about knowing my enemy. Like if I knew if Bush and all these other people that are like in the public view, that mostly to me don't seem like they actually are the ones wielding the power, they came to kind of seem like puppets to me. But if all these Rothschild and all these type people, if they actually were shape-shifting lizards, then my approach to them would be completely different. And if it was, I know, let's just imagine that it was true that there was none of this stuff going on. And I have to say, I'm not saying that. I definitely recognize that it's going on. If it was true that it wasn't going on, then that would be could be factored out, and you could look at them and deal with them in a completely different way. And I think a lot of the time, like I said, the people that get pushed forward as, oh, these are the ones that are controlling us. I think they themselves are, they're not at the top of the pyramid. They're themselves being controlled. And it's not like this one kind of entity that's like just passing stuff down from the top of the pyramid. It is a system. And if you are the kind of person that, goes to university and studies politics and then starts working in some kind of junior post and works your way up in a lifetime politician, you can end up like being like Dominique Strauss-Kahn without there being something within you that's like, oh, he was a sicko and a parrot and a psychopath and everything when he was born. I don't really believe necessarily that. I mean, maybe there is, but it seems to me, and that's why I wrote against the idea of saying there is something inside them. But there's clearly, at the time when they commit their acts, by that point there definitely is something that's totally different. And the book that I was writing in the wake of was The Psychopath Test by John Ronson. And there's a point in there which they are now at the point where they're doing things markedly different. They don't have any empathy or any connection with what the earlier thing that you were talking about, how we are here now and it falls to us. We're part of this collective thing. They don't have any real, thoughts in that regard at all. They're endlessly exploiting their own for their own ends. So.
Right. Well, one of the things that the opportunities for me in looking at somebody like Leonard Cohen and generally the whole idea of social cultural engineering as a deeper level to mere conspiracies is that while I don't reject your description of individual behaviors that are psychopathic, I mean, there's no way to get around that. People committing these things, well, there's two elements that I think do change the picture, at least two to begin with. One is that we don't know who those individuals are, and we don't know that we're able to recognize them. We don't know that a sociopath, in fact, we can pretty much assume that they won't look or act like sociopaths. So we don't know that some of our heroes, not to mention some of our neighbors, friends, even relatives, aren't in that class, right? We just don't know. We're going to get back to the bedrock of what we know. The other thing that we don't know is that these supposed sociopaths aren't operating, well, we know they're operating on a different kind of cognitive level to what we operate on, assuming that, you know, you and I are not of that class, which I am assuming. So we know that they think differently, but we don't know that they're not at a high level. Or at least that they don't believe that they're at a higher level. But if we're really going to be absolutely honest, and this is what I've had to go into with the social engineering around Strieber and now around Cohen, is that it seems that these agendas are based on a belief in a kind of philanthropic goal to accelerate evolution for the benefit of mankind, some sort of spiritual goal. Now, I'm absolutely convinced that's all a cover, you know, a self-justification.
Agreed.
But, nevertheless, the point is that the these psychopaths committing psychopathic acts of evil may fully believe that it is for the good of all. So, how do you judge when you're getting into that kind of level of distortion, if we're going to look at it that way, and I do, but if we're going to admit just a different paradigm.
Well, yeah. I would say that the way that you can still know that what they're doing is absolutely horrendous is by returning to first principles. So the people that flew planes into the World Trade Center tower, whoever they were, they did it not for any specific, oh, yeah, you know what I'm really up for today? Yeah, I think I'll skip breakfast down at the Sailor's Cafe. I think I'll do that. It was obviously down due to an ideology, and that ideology necessarily entails the idea that this is going to bring about this millenarianism. It's going to bring about something good. Yeah, we want to break through to get to the times and the paradigm. Bring it on. You know, it's bring it all on. So it's it's hit the here and now. And when someone does something because they think that it's good for everything else, I think that's firstly part of their kind of shattered and messed up psyche kind of justifying itself to themselves, probably, because I don't think that they necessarily were born evil. They've kind of, in a way, themselves been indoctrinated, and they may have taken part in their own self-indoctrination. But we know that we just look at those choices that they're making and know that they're never going to lead to anything positive, because if we can identify what positive values are, like life and happiness and connection with other people and wholeness, then we can look and see that those things will never and can never lead to it, not just consequentially, but in the moment, the single act itself. What does it do? What does it assume? Why is it being done? And I don't think that there's any, for me, there's no ambiguity whatsoever. I don't want to spend any time thinking, well, maybe they could be on, if there's anything right or anything.
We see that, but that's the liminal state. In liminal state, everything is ambiguous. There's nothing but ambiguity. And you're, I think, rightly identifying the enemy, quote unquote, or the problem or the pathologies relating to ideology. I would agree. But But then it's an ideology to want to extinguish that ideology, or to somehow want to counteract it with another set of beliefs or values. And you know, this might sound idealist or something, or impossible to maintain, and maybe it is, but it's also based on what I was talking about earlier, this very innate sense that I have that what we're here for, if we accept it's not just to have a good time and then die, which is just completely futile, so might as well, as I say, just have a miserable time and then die, whatever, you know. If it's not just that, to seek our own happiness, then it's so far beyond this metaphoric matrix-like existence we're in that at a certain level, I do have to say, I don't know what good and evil is. I don't have the tools to say whether this is good or bad. All I can try and do, and I certainly wouldn't try and do it with the Twin Towers or something like that, because I think that probably positive things did come out of that, but mostly negative, I'd agree. But with something more specific like sexual abuse of children, now I can't take a moral position on that and say that is just fundamentally wrong. But what I can do is look at and even testify to the untold harm that that does to a child's psyche, and how difficult it makes that child, once they grow up, to actually just live a life and connect to people and just be in their bodies and just be at peace. And now, but I can't say that's bad. Like, that can be an opportunity. Like, for me, it's been this opportunity. I think you were touching on that with your own family history, that, you know, bad things happen, but they do create opportunities for discovery. So even there, I can't say, well, that means child abuse is bad because ta ta ta. But at least let's get clear about the facts here, because there's an awful lot of bullshit justification, like Richard Dawkins saying, well, I was diddled as a kid and I'm fine. I'm
Yeah,
not traumatized because I don't
he's
remember
far from
anything.
fine. It's obvious. To me, anyway, looking at him,
Well,
he's not.
not to him though, not and not to many other people. So, and I just threw him out there as an example because, well, I suppose, I mean, at the end of the day, and maybe this relates to what I was saying, or maybe it doesn't, but at the end of the day, our own wholeness is, that's our task, and that may only be the necessary foundation to fulfill our function or our mission in the universe. Who only knows? But that's not something we could ever understand mentally, but intuitively I sense we do have a purpose. I mean, bees have a purpose, everything else has a purpose, why wouldn't we? It's not just a, you know, be destructive sociopathic society. But before we even get to that, the real, you know, bees make honey, what do human beings make? Purpose. We need to achieve wholeness as individuals. So when you're talking about this society's fucked, let's go create another.
No, not as current of a society.
Well, whatever. Let's make our own space in which we can be away, you know, outside of society. That will create a society, though. That's the thing. It will. I mean, how do you think society began in the first place? It also began as just a bunch of people settling in a place and living off the land. So what's different? What makes you think that the community that you participated in wouldn't be carrying the same?
Well, people lived in band societies for 2 million years without any of them growing into tribes. And there's even archaeological evidence that these people actually knew that if they allowed themselves to grow bigger and allowed themselves to take on technologies that they could imagine but not that they hadn't used, that it would
Right.
lead to things like exploitation. And the creation of specialists, which would then begin start to predate upon the wider body, and then they understood because they could they sometimes they were living close to people that had grown into tribes, and they'd oh Christ, we don't want any of that. That's war and everything like that. So I wouldn't say that, you know, just people settling and living in groups is what leads to terrible things. I think that you can look at the history of civilization as a process and see that there are definite stages where certain behavioral characteristics were taken on. And I think that there was a non-violent, soft heteronomous process, which was the creation of specialists who then invented and interpreted ritual and imposed it upon other people, the shaman mm-hmm. class.
Like the false ceremony masters.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. That step, although not totally irrevocable, led to the next step, and then pretty soon, you know, power and domination emerge, mm-hmm. as it were, but organically. But without those previous steps, it's total. You need each one of those steps to get to the stage of, like, you know, the Babylonians, and by that stage they're already, you know, that's it. If to use your quote of me, I don't know if I said it or if you're summarizing it, society was already fucked by like 3000 BC. In the way that I'm objecting to it now, so mm-hmm. I don't think that, and I can explain, if you like, what elements of the enclave that I would be setting up with other people that want to do that, why it would be so unlikely that any of those processes would ever begin.
Forgive me, I mean, for wanting to express cynicism there and not really be interested in the older breakdown of how, I mean, I might be interested, but not at this juncture in the conversation, because it's like, again, there's a cause. I mean, it seems to me that you're describing effects, but you've sounds like you've done a lot of work, maybe good work mapping out effects and tracing effects far enough back that you think you get to the cause. But what you describe isn't a cause. Like this false ceremony master class emerging and ruining everything. That's not the cause. You haven't identified what caused that class to emerge in the first place, or what it was in them that caused them to want to exploit. And the assumption is that whatever it was in them isn't in everyone else. And if it wasn't them exploiting, or if you removed them, that it wouldn't happen in any group. Like if you can get, have you the Stanford experiment thing,
mm-hmm.
whatever it was,
yeah.
Where they had people pretend that they were prisoners,
yeah.
guards, right? So, okay, that's an extreme case, because obviously the environment there is conducive, and more than conducive, to that kind of behavior, because it's like a morphogenetic field. But still, I think it illustrates something, which is just that there is something inherent in human beings, and I don't necessarily mean biologically, but like I say, at the moment it's been untraceable, and this is why I do have time for, not actually for David Icke himself, but for those kind of interpretation systems that do entail a non-human element, because it's kind of understandable. I mean, like, there's a question mark. It's like the missing link of socio-psychological, history, or trying to map where we went wrong as a species. There's this missing thing, like, what happened? What happened to cause this pathology in human beings? Now, I'm tentatively trace it to language in some way, that it does relate to language and trauma, and how, and some relationship between trauma and language. But that's still, I mean, that's whatever. I mean, that's, I'm trying to get,
Well,
it's not a historical. I don't think historically, I think we're really at a disadvantage, because I think we need to be able to study what's happening right now in our own psyches, and our own development as individuals, and as above, so below. I think it's constantly repeating whatever it is, this thing that went wrong. I think it's constantly happening. And that's why I would say that any community that we set up, not that the same thing will happen again. I mean, sure, you could keep it small enough that it didn't happen, but would that be a worthwhile goal if all that is about is just, I mean, that's an animal goal, and that's not to denigrate animals. And I do think it's the foundation for something to return to that simple, pure way of living. But it can't be the end. I mean, if all of this evolution, or whatever you want to call it, is just so that we can say, "Are we really fucked up? Let's just go back to small communities." I don't know. I mean, it's just that I shouldn't use the term evolution, because that's biological. That just seems like it's just purely biological.
well, I mean, it's not just about the size of the community. I mean, you mentioned before, like, we're the ones here and now, and it falls to us. The book that I'm writing, which has changed shape a lot of times, is basically the main thesis of it. Might seem obvious to a lot of people, but then they don't recognize as obvious the further premises that fall out of it. Is that, everything that we see in the world is a result of what's in people's minds, and not just in individual minds, but collectively as a system, and how the very things that we see every day are the result of these kind of generally held ideas. And a lot of these generally held ideas, where have they come from? And we can trace it back. And I think it does. I think language is very, very important. The sources that I've used in anthropology have shown that in the Upper Paleolithic era, then language and this kind of specialization, these false ceremony masters, rose at the same time. So, there's definitely an interplay there. And I guess you could say that I'm satisfied with that because I'm more than concerned with effects. And, another person could be like, I really, really want to understand the absolute cause so that I can be surer that it won't happen again if once I've understood it. But I think it comes down to also, if the bee makes honey and the fox just acts like a fox, it does that because it doesn't have language and culture in the same way. It doesn't have a symbolic thing. I mean, maybe when birds tweet to one another, maybe they are saying something complex, but I think it's just completely intuitive. They hear the sound. They don't go, okay, and then there's a meaning, and then there's an action. It's intuitive, and it's just reflexive for them. So, I think that one of the things I've contemplated is that in an enclave, would I really need to talk to anybody? Because if I don't talk to them, then that rules out the possibility of all this kind of linguistic ambiguity, and then all these other things arising. I don't think I would necessarily need to. So I recognize that language has so many problems, and I, while I'm using it to try to meet and connect with the people that might in the future be the like-minded people I'm living with in an enclave, then I need to be very specific about what I mean so that there isn't an ambiguity. But in the future, that ambiguity could be removed by removing language. So I don't see it necessarily as a function of pure size, but as what's in people's minds. And that obviously, there's an absolute feedback loop. Terrible, horrible places create horrible thoughts in people's minds that create horrible places and conditions. So it's about breaking breaking the cycle.
Yeah. So yeah, again, but so what's the source of these terrible, horrible thoughts? Is still remains unknown. I think there's a danger in what you're describing, and I felt it before as well, kind of there on the periphery, my felt sense of it anyway, in that you're describing an environment, an enclave, that would require a certain degree of imposition on the way of living. Because, okay, this is the, we know the way, we don't want it to be, so we have to put certain restrictions on, whether it's size, whether it's language, whatever it is, technology. We if you have to put restrictions on, then I just don't think that's going to work.
It's not about restriction, Jason. It's that my central belief is that one of the main reasons why there's so much chaos is that people that don't agree on things will never live together, and that mass society, and certainly global mass society, was an accident. It wasn't something that was always going to happen. And for 2 million happen. And at that time, there wasn't the need for imposition because people lived in balance with nature. They lived in balance between the genders, and they didn't have any of the serious problems that I'm describing. And
yes, but in a certain sense,
if I was to be successful and found this enclave, it would be with people that had already, by consensus, totally understood and totally agreed with me on the fundamental values of that place. Therefore, there's nothing then to be imposed, because people will go there and they will just naturally live in the way that we've all agreed on living. And it's not just like a contractual thing, like we will do this. It's like there is no other way for us.
Yes, well, you're talking about ideology. You're talking about you have a way of thinking and seeing the world, and everyone has to agree with you. And once they agree, then they can join your enclave. And if they start to diverge from that agreement, or if you discover nuances in their way of thinking that don't agree, then what? They'll have to leave, right? It's,
well, first of all, it's an anti-ideological stance. It's not an ideology in itself. It's,
well, yes, but anti-ideology is ideology. And, you know, what you're, I would say you're not considering, and maybe you're not ready to, and maybe this won't make any sense to you, but when you're talking about, sorry, I didn't, if that sounded patronizing, I didn't mean it to, but, I mean, it is a tough one. I've never thought of it until this moment, that, when you talk about society as an imposition on our nature, I agree, but if you pull back further, you could say that society is just an extension of nature. And so to try and change society or improve it, that's an imposition on the greater nature. You know, the whole universe is whatever it is, this perceptual field that we're in, that we're participating in and inseparable from, it just is what it is. So what I'm hearing from you over and over again is basically you don't like the way things are. You want to recreate the world in your own image so that you can live there happily ever after with your own people. Now, it's a perfectly natural thing to feel and to want, but I don't think it's realistic.
Well, I don't think it's my image at all. I think
sure it is.
I think that there are things called truths, and I think that I've met people who can see that non-violence and reason are just fundamentally preferable to violence and non-reason. And, you know, if there's enough of us to actually logistically set up this enclave, okay, we're not going there because it's in my image or because it's in the image of any specific person there. It starts, that's what the word consentient means. It means that they're thinking together, that they've had exposure and experience of all the same kind of inputs from within the current system, recognized each element of it, which is wholly negative, and then come to the conclusion, not because I've just said, "Hey, look at this, read my book," and then they're like devotees of me, but because they've reached that via their own path and their own truths. And then those people, us, if you like, the group of us, would then say, "Okay, well, we've all wanted this. I haven't told you to want it. You haven't started wanting it when I've described the enclave, the image of it existing." And then you thought, "Oh, that's good. You've wanted it beforehand. You've wanted it independently of anything that I've communicated to you. So if we all want that now, it's going to be difficult for us. It's going to be costly and risky for us. But let's go and do that." And the idea of that is as an escape, not as a formation in itself. If there wasn't something to escape from, if there was a way of doing it, without having to escape, physically escape society and the mass system, then I would do that without it. But the fact is that the influence of the dominant culture is so wide and vast that it really would need a physical escape. Otherwise, it would break down. And you asked a specific question about, or you raised a specific point about people that would emerge from within that, children and future generations that would not agree with it. I mean, if you don't agree with the incumbent paradigm, you just get crushed under like a bug. There's no attempt to kind of, there's no dialogue like, "Well, we've got this because it's the way that it is." It's based on force, and it's based on total destruction of the individual. So, first of all, like I said, there are lots and lots of reasons that I can suppose why in a group, in a community who have a total dedication to nonviolence and reason and consentient values, it's very, very difficult to imagine why such elements might emerge that completely disagree. So I think
Not for me. It's very hard to imagine how they wouldn't. I mean, it's like you're leaving out the whole question of the unconscious. You're approaching it as though people were simply their thoughts and their feelings and their beliefs and their opinions. That's all that people can agree about anyway. But 99% of us as individuals and collectively is unconscious. And that's always what rules the day. That's why, I mean, what you're describing has been attempted thousands of times. And, without going into the various unknown, interfering elements, where it's actually been sabotaged from day one. But there are, they're not, it's not a very pretty picture that's been painted by all these various different communities that have set themselves up with an identical vision to your own, and with the assumption that somehow human nature will out, and that of course we can all agree, on what's good and what's the right way of living. But the evidence is,
really, I've never seen a
overwhelming.
single example referred to of something which is identical to my own ideas. I've never seen that because
Well, I
there's
didn't
been.
say your idea. The basic idea of creating an enclave away from society where natural law will, carry the day.
I
That
didn't say
basic idea.
natural law, and I don't like that term. But I mean, the reason if it's not identical, then it's not comparable because there would be ideas within that which would contribute towards the destruction of that idea. If you go and say, "Okay, well, we're going to go off and do this," and everything's what I'm saying, except, okay, now it's an Islamic thing. Well, it's not going to work because there are elements within Islam which would
So do you
work
think that
with that
you're not
ideology.
carrying an ideology then?
Well, I mean, it depends on what your definition of an ideology is. And what my definition is, as I use the word, the idea of a consentient community is by definition non-ideological because these people don't have to follow some kind of set of ideas for any other reason that they all actually at that moment think them. They don't have to follow it. It's their natural way, having deconditioned themselves as much as they can.
Okay, well, there you go. As much as they can. So, but how much is that really? How much can do most people that have they really deconditioned themselves?
I'm not talking about most people.
No,
it's
the
not.
people that you'd want to invite into the enclave, those people.
Well, I mean, if you if a person realizes that violence, they have a clear understanding of what violence is, and they have a total commitment to non-violence.
But that, I mean, that's such a mouthful. Like, I don't know anyone who has a clear understanding of what violence is, and I certainly don't know anyone who has a total commitment to against it, whatever the phrase you use. They might say they do, but I sure as hell wouldn't believe them, because you don't know until, the push comes to shove when the
Yeah,
shit hits the
which is
fan.
exactly why phase one, after these people have met and they've said, okay, this is something that we're interested in, phase one is then totally exploring that over a long period so that everybody in it feels sure and comfortable. It's not like, okay, let's just go to the island now. That would be short-sighted. Then you would miss things that might later then, rise up and dismantle it. But I really, when you said that it's been tried countless times, I don't think that what I'm describing has ever been tried.
But
From
none of
what
the
I've
other people
seen.
thought that too. I mean, everyone who's done it thought that this would
Well,
be the
which
one that would
examples are you
work.
referring to? Give me a concrete example.
Well, Findhorn and I don't, Waco, Jonestown. I mean, most of the examples I know, obviously, are really compromised because they were probably psyops. But who's to say, what's a psyop and what isn't? Like, your thing could become a psyop if you invite the wrong people in. Maybe it's
Sure.
all a psyop. So, but I mean, the best intentions and the road to hell and all that thing. I mean, I'd be more comfortable talking there than specifics, which is the point that you didn't address, which is people have an unconscious. And if you're going to create a space in which, I guess for people to be deconditioned, that's what it sounds like to me. I mean, I totally agree that the idea of having an environment in which people can remove themselves from society and begin to discover new ways of being in the community and integrating with others is great. I mean, I've considered doing it myself. But that I would say that that's, whew, boy. I mean, it's that's the means to something else. I mean, that what you're describing is somehow creating would be way on down the line, and maybe that's what you're acknowledging by saying you wouldn't just, move to the
Yeah,
island.
I'm just a little bit confused that at the beginning when I was laying out my basic ideas, you kind of said, well, that would be something that you consider signing on for. And then in the last few minutes, it seemed almost like, if you don't mind me saying so, a little bit like an interrogation of various things. And I think that one of the things I would say to kind of, anybody that I'm actually laying out my ideas to is, if you don't want any part of it, you don't have to be a part of it. And if you think it will fail, I really appreciate you telling me why you think it will fail. But then if after hearing it, I'm still thinking, okay, well, I don't know what part the unconscious plays. I don't have a very good understanding of that. Maybe you've got a much better understanding of the unconscious than I have. But I also feel a sense of urgency that events in the wider world are really looking like they're going to completely collapse very soon. And I think before they collapse, there's actually going to be an absolutely enormous war. And I don't want to be victim of, this is a phrase I use all the time, I don't want to be victim of or drafted into a fascist army. And I see that escape as being a very, very urgent thing. So a matter of years, really, is left before that can happen. And if by folly I say, well, okay, for me and for the other people involved in this, the unconscious is not such a big consideration and we fail as a result. Well, at least we tried. That's my current view. And I think that if we were to wait around for like a complete understanding of everything, I think the parable of the poisoned arrow.
I do. It's at my KubeCon forum, actually, as a disclaimer about the possible futility of intellectual inquiry.
Yes.
That one,
So,
yeah.
I mean, right. So, I think that, just kind of, there may be an unlimited, a literally unlimited number of things that you need to consider before the possibility of an absolutely sustainable community would be possible. And that there may be that without that unlimited number, if any one of the number, or maybe it's finite, but very, very big, and if one of those is missing, then it'll eventually fail. But I just have to say that what I was saying about these elements not rising up in the future from within, I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying it's far less likely, like orders of magnitude far less likely. Because if you have like what people call peaceful parenting, that's just never happened on a mass scale anywhere in history, peaceful parenting. So if there's a, let's say there's 25 people in this enclave, and all of them are committed to peaceful parenting, then the kind of traumas that arise from, you know, non-peaceful parenting are really, really far less likely. And then that's one element among dozens and dozens and dozens of things, you know, the non-presence of harmful things in people's diet and vaccines and fertilizers and everything else like that. It just seems to me like it's much, much more likely that good things will happen. And if it fails in the future, then my view would be at that moment, for whatever reason it failed, I would say to myself, well, at least I tried. And one of the things that people say to me is, oh, they'd get you eventually. Someone from the outside, the civilization of origin, would turn up, some kind of army would turn up. And I was like, well, at the moment where my island has been infiltrated by these, you know, these grunts, and they've got rifles or whatever it is in the future shoved in my face, and they're about to blow my head off, I would just comfort myself of, you know, at least I gave it a good shot, and maybe I managed to live with several years of freedom, you know, and real happiness that wasn't compromised by having to live in a basically an insane asylum, which is what I see the current civilization as. You know, at least I would have had that before I died. And you know, you talked before about having value in life. If there's no value in life, then you might as well live a miserable life. Those are the values that I've chosen. And it's not like they're closed. This conversation is not like it's got no possibility of informing those values. It's got every possibility. One of the things that I wanted to say, I kept forgetting to say, was when you said we are here now and it falls to us. If you combine that idea with the idea that everything that happens in the result in the world is a result of people's, what's in people's minds, and then therefore their thoughts inform their actions, well, what are we doing right now? We're doing just about one of the best things you can do. We're talking to each other. We're communicating our thoughts to each other. There's no force involved. There's no violence involved. You offer your thoughts to me. I listen to them, and vice versa. That's about as good as it can get. So in an enclave where that, or possibly language is not even required for that, I think it has a really, really, really good chance of succeeding in the goal that it had or has. Sorry, I don't know if you know you'll be able to edit this into a workable podcast, because I do just tend to ramble. I do apologize.
There's no need to apologize. I didn't want to come back with a rejoinder because A, we've been on 2 hours, and B, I don't want to feel like I'm just, well, I don't want you to feel like I'm just trying to shoot down all your ideas. So, I mean, yeah.
I mean, the reason I've reached out to you is that obviously I'm interested in your ideas, which we haven't dealt with as much as we have the stuff that I've been thinking about. And maybe if there's time left for you, I could move on to some of the questions that I've got for you. But it's also to get, you know, you're someone that I've deemed as being really interesting. And, you know, I'd like to talk to people, which includes not only hearing about their ideas, but, you know, getting their opinion on what I'm thinking. So please don't think that all the things I've said in response to what I've said has gone unheeded. And if I can get a copy of this conversation, I think I'd probably listen back to it quite a lot to pick up on your thoughts again and again.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, as I say, I mean, I don't want to just be trying to pick apart your grand vision. I don't even know anything about it except what you've told me, so it's a very, you know, the larger, not the specifics, just the larger thing. And I'm certainly not opposed to experimenting and trying things out. I would say, I guess, as a maybe a last rejoinder, that well, one thing that living together with people is just so underestimated, just how hard that is. That's one thing. I mean, really, it's like the hardest thing in the world. That's why the world is the way it is, partly. But the other thing is more general, was look at your motivation. Because I think that our motivations, A, they're usually unconscious, and B, because of that, our motivations determine the outcome much more than our intentions. And so, as you've described to me, it seems to me your motivations are largely to do with, as you put it, living in an insane asylum and just wanting to get the hell out. And I would say that's a questionable motivation, because you were born in an insane asylum for a reason. And there's actually a very rich opportunity here. I mean, this is what I was trying to get at earlier. This is the spiritual perspective, and I haven't used that word, and I've even haven't gone into descriptions that might, you know, be that, because it's a difficult area. But the spiritual perspective, or the deeper or the more holistic perspective, is that it's just you and the universe. That's it. And so all the different variables that you can't actually, I don't think, if you're honest, maybe you feel you can, I can't, separate them out and say this is good and this is bad, or even, you know, oh, this is part of the system and this is part of nature, or there's many different ways I could frame that. The overall point I'm making is that it's just me and the field of perception that I ended up in, and it's all material to work with. Not in a cynical way or an exploitative way, but just this is, I mean, how do we explore our unconscious when we can't go directly to it? We have to look outside of ourselves and see the ways in which our environment is actually reflecting our own inner state. And that's quite a leap. I mean, you have to talk a lot to make that, you know, a ontologically established, you know, interpretation, but anyway, that's mine, that our external environment always reflects our inner state in some way or another, or very directly. So, I'll reduce this to a bit of a fortune cookie thing now, but that, I don't think that we can change anything until we've accepted things the way they are. So in a marriage, say, I've been married for several years, things do change when, you know, things that I really don't like, they do change over time, but they only change once I've accepted that that's the way they are, and maybe that's the way they'll always be. Because if I'm constantly trying to change the other person, that actually reinforces the very pattern that I'm finding so abrasive. And I think you can extend that out to the whole world.
That's and really that
every attempted solution has only made the problem worse because of this, because we're constantly, you know, resistance makes stronger. I'm sure that martial arts is, you know, you could apply this, but it's also in the realm of psychology. What we disown, what we don't like, we disown, we project it onto the shadow that empowers the other in a way that they take on those projections and they become the very thing that we think they are. So we just constantly reinforce the very thing that we're trying to get free of. And the only thing that works is complete blanket acceptance of it, in my view. And so to want to create an enclave, I think it's a great idea, even if only as an experiment. But I would say that the more it's predicated on a rejection of society and a refusal to accept it, the more you will take that energy into the enclave and just create the very thing that you're trying to get away from.
Well, thank you for that. That's really interesting. And as you were talking, I managed to tie that to things in my own personal life as well. So I can see that operating on different levels. It's just that when I think of what I mean by the word society, I just think that, you know, the mass society as it is not a natural thing, and it's happened as a result of, you know, a discrete number of big mistakes, you know, across the years, and it's very difficult for me to accept. That's what it is, I guess. It comes down to very, very difficult for me to accept. When I think about accepting something the way it is, I guess for me there's like a kind of essentialism in that, the way that it is, which kind of says that that is fixed, whereas I think that everything is kind of more fluid and subject to feedback loops, and therefore things
Yeah.
can be changed. So I think that
Well, they change of their own accord, though. Like you say,
maybe,
everything's constantly changing. So accepting things as they are is, I think that is what allows them to change, as opposed to if we're constantly interfering and saying this could be this way, then that keeps breaking that flow and it keeps resetting. And there's something about the Tao, you know. Have you read the Tao Te Ching? And I don't
Many,
usually
many years ago,
recommend
I don't really have
spiritual texts.
any memory of it really.
Well, there's something in there that I think is the kernel of value. That, and again, the word spirituality is not one I want to use, but there's this space in our understanding where, unfortunately, spirituality and the beliefs have filled that space in religion and God and all the rest of it. But if you strip away all those things, the space is then there, and it's like there's something actually that is moving everything, and it's not us, and that does sort everything out and restore balance, if only we would just leave enough space for it to do what it has to do. That's
Yeah, that's an interesting
absolutely my,
idea. I don't reject the idea of some kind of, you know, whatever you might call it, higher power. It's just that I haven't really felt it in that way. So
Well, I would
it
say
hasn't.
start with instinct. That's why I brought up natural law. I mean, start with the recognition that instinct, once upon a time, was enough for us to be guided. And now it's no longer enough. So does that mean we've got to go back to the instincts? Well, yes. But it also means we can't ever go back, because you can't ever go back. That we have to discover something that is like instinct, but not the same, and is somehow beyond instinct. You could say higher or deeper. Or it's not just survival. It's a intuitive guidance system that guides us where we need to go, and not just where the food is or the shelter or the sex. You know, it's there's something else, something moving us towards something even beyond this world. I mean, not even, but specifically beyond this world.
Monkey said to man, I want your fire. Man said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
And there ends my conversation with Bennett Freeman of consentient.wordpress.com. Once again, those who haven't heard this spiel before, do welcome support on this podcast. Whether it's moral or financial or otherwise, you can comment at the blog or the website. You can join the forum, kubricon.com/maze. You can even donate on a one-time basis at PayPal, or on a monthly basis at patreon.com/liminalist. Every little bit helps. Thanks for listening. This has been Who Is This? You have been listening to Jason Horsley, The Liminalist, the podcast between.
And this was all that monkeys built when his world came tumbling down.
La vie dans la jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Des lèvres, l'air de bois, tout pose des problèmes. Les songes sur les arbres préparent.